Friends, a very warm welcome to St. Margaret's Church, Westminster Abbey, for this afternoon's lecture. I hope you've had a very good morning. We are in the church in which is buried Sir Walter Raleigh, that other great Tudor figure. But before we begin, I want you to put your hands up if you're in the process of applying to university at the moment. So quite a few of you. Let me tell you, one of the greatest joys of university is getting to know people who don't do your course. Now, Dr. John Guy, who is a fellow of Clare College, Cambridge, and I, first met through sitting next to each other at a university lunch, university dinner, and this sense of being alongside people who are absolute thoroughbred experts in their field, which is not necessarily your field, is one of the greatest joys of a university life. That sense of mutual connection, of finding interdisciplinary links with your own subject. John is one of our most foremost Tudor historians. He is somebody who has developed a reputation over decades of being a key expert in his field, and many of you will have come across him maybe unknowingly through watching the film Mary, Queen of Scots, Two Queens, One Future. John wrote the book upon which this film is based, My Heart is My Own, and is somebody who has managed to balance a career not just as an absolutely top academic historian, but also somebody who is able to make connections with the worlds of film, of theatre and drama, of biography and of fiction. There really is no better guide to the relationship between Elizabeth Tudor and Mary Stuart. So this afternoon, this is for you, and possibly for me in this context, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to hear from somebody who knows this field and these two remarkable women better than almost anybody else. John, thank you so much for being here. A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much. In 1561, Mary, Queen of Scots, returned from France to take up her throne. She'd left Scotland as a child during what were effectively civil wars in Scotland. She'd been sent to the safety of France. She'd married the French Dauphin. She'd briefly been Queen of France. The Dauphin had become King Francis II. He had died. Catherine de' Medici, the then regent of France, didn't particularly like Mary very much, and so Mary decided she would return home. She also wanted to return home. She believed that she was called to return home, called by God, actually, to return home and be the Queen of Scots. Elizabeth Tudor, Anne Boleyn's daughter, had succeeded to the throne in 1558, just 3 years before. Now, these are relatively young women. There is a nine-year age gap. Mary is 9 years younger than Elizabeth, and actually she looks even younger in that particular image because that's painted when she's 15 in 1558. It's just at the point when she's about to be betrothed to the Dauphin of France. That one's a little bit later. You're getting not quite a world first, but that portrait on the right has never been seen since it disappeared into California sometime probably in the 1950s when it was overpainted and thought to be somebody else. It returned to auction at Bonhams in December 2019. It's the earliest recognisable decent portrait of Elizabeth that actually looks like her, that is taken, that is painted while she was queen, at a time when all the other portraits of Elizabeth after she had acceded to the throne were said to look nothing like her whatsoever, and that's the Earl of Sussex who is saying that. So you can see here two relatively young women. Now, they are relatively still inexperienced. Elizabeth has a steely temperament, yes, but she has to deal with very experienced male counsellors, and that's even more so for Mary. Now, the key thing to know, probably the most important thing you ever need to know about Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth, is that they were not mortal enemies from the beginning of the story. You know, you may have seen old A-level questions which said which was the greater threat to Elizabeth I, Mary, Queen of Scots, or the Puritans. I mean, forget it. That is just codswallop. In the first place, no one really knew what a Puritan was in the 1560s. And if there were any, they certainly weren't a threat. Quite the opposite, I suspect. There was no way that Mary was seen by Elizabeth herself as a threat. These are two relatively young women, very curious about each other. Both believed that they were called by God. They were both anointed queens with holy oil. They believed they were anointed by, essentially, or called by God to rule their subjects. They believed they were accountable to God alone. More to the point, I think, each woman was the only woman on the planet who knew what it was to be like in the other one's shoes. Young, surrounded by ambitious courtiers at every turn. Now, of course, naturally, between these two women, and of course, they're cousins. They're actually second cousins, but actually, they called each other cousin. They called each other sister. When in the film they called each other sister, this is not Hollywood fiction. They actually called each other sister. They had this sisterly relationship. And like all siblings, there was a certain amount of rivalry, but it was over things like, what does she look like? Is she taller than me? Is her complexion better than mine? Can she play the virginals better than I can? All those sort of things. They were not yet political rivalries between the two women. But of course, they both have to deal with experienced male counsellors. And Mary had to deal with these two. On the left, James Stuart, Earl of Murray. On the right, William Maitland of Lethington, also known as the Scottish, at least by his critics, as the Scottish Cecil, the man who could wheel and deal and wriggle in and out of every possible corner. James Stuart is the illegitimate half-brother of Mary, Queen of Scots. He is the man who thinks he ought to be king because he's a bloke. But of course, legitimacy stands in the way. He's ambitious. He's ostensibly friendly and brotherly to Mary, but he's always looking for the best possible chance. He postures, as many politicians do, as the protector of the Commonwealth and the servant of the people and all of that stuff. But actually, his character is best inferred and worked out from the things that he actually does. Maitland of Lethington, clever. He was also known as Mickle Wiley, which was a pun on Machiavelli. He's also known as the chameleon because he can change his colour, change his affiliation. These Scottish lords change their affiliations and they change their sort of alliances with kaleidoscopic frequency. Now, both guys, they go to see Mary before she returns to Scotland, but after the moment when she said she's coming back. And they go to make deals. And this is where it first starts to get quite interesting, because Murray goes to talk to her about the religious settlement in Scotland. While Mary was away, Scotland had been ruled by her mother as regent, Marie de Guise, who was her mother, and she was the French princess who had married Mary's father, James the Fifth. But of course, James the Fifth was killed or died in 1542. There was a sort of period, as I've said, of what's tantamount to civil war. But in the end, the winner was Marie de Guise, who became regent. Now, she was a Catholic, and Scotland had been a Catholic country. But James Stuart, Earl of Murray, joined a Protestant revolt called the Revolt of the Lords of the Congregation. The Scottish nobles, who were ambitious, they wanted to achieve more, who latched onto Calvinism. They attracted genuine Calvinists. And a religious revolution took place in Scotland. And as part of that, James Stuart, Earl of Murray, attempted to depose Marie de Guise and replace her with a council of 24 nobles. It didn't work, but Marie de Guise helped him out by dying of dropsy shortly afterwards. So at the beginning of this story, before Mary is about to return to France, Scotland is ruled by a council of 24 Protestant nobles. And this guy is the most important figure. Now, when James Stuart goes to meet Mary, he wants that religious settlement to be preserved. And Mary does an extraordinary thing for the 16th century. She is a devout Catholic. Her mother was a devout Catholic. This guy has actually attempted to depose her mother, but she keeps her cool, and she agrees with him that when she returns to Scotland, the Protestant settlement, the status quo, will be preserved as long as she can worship with her own household as Catholics in the royal chapels in the Scottish palaces. And there's an inference here also that provided Catholics elsewhere in Scotland worship quietly and don't, you know, present themselves as troublemakers in the society as a whole, that situation can continue. So here's a remarkable thing. Elizabeth would never have done anything like that. She would never have granted essentially de facto religious toleration to Catholics. Elizabeth had Catholic sympathies, but it doesn't mean to say that she was interested in official toleration. And of course, Elizabeth's ministers did not allow this situation to arise when the suggestion was that Elizabeth would marry Charles of Austria, who was a sort of moderate Catholic, but wanted to worship in his own chapel as a Catholic. This was absolutely forbidden, and the deal was off. Now, Maitland of Lethington went with a different agenda. He wanted, Mary to make a pact with Elizabeth, and came up with a proposal which Mary quickly made her own and held on to it for the rest of her life, that she would recognize Elizabeth despite the questions over Elizabeth's legitimacy. Remember, when Elizabeth was conceived, her father was not officially married to her. He was still officially married to Catherine of Aragon when Elizabeth was conceived. There was later a supposed annulment which was not recognized by Catholics, and so on. And also Elizabeth had been bastardized by Parliament. So if you're on the legitimacy ticket, you don't necessarily think that Elizabeth is the strongest horse to back. But Mary and Maitland worked out this deal whereby Mary would offer to recognize Elizabeth as the lawful, legitimate Queen of England in exchange for being recognized as the heir apparent, as the number two, or as it was put, the highest person in the realm being the next person to succeed. And that, I think, is an extraordinary deal. This deal was put to Elizabeth, and Elizabeth considered it, as we will see later on in this talk, several times. So Mary is, you know, far from being Elizabeth's mortal enemy, far from being the person who comes in and poses an immediate terrible threat, either religious or dynastic. Actually, this woman is extraordinary for the 16th century, for her willingness to compromise and, if you like, accept the realities of power, especially if Scotland is a much weaker monarchy than the English monarchy. And in fact, this woman, there is absolutely no evidence that Mary, Queen of Scots, was any less astute than Elizabeth politically. Of course, it was much more difficult to be a queen in Scotland. But when you actually look at the facts, as opposed to doing your sort of Googler historian thing and looking it all up in Wikipedia very out of date books which are influenced not by searching the archives and actually reading these women's letters, but essentially by propaganda which has come down to us, you know, through the centuries, pro-Protestant propaganda, anti-Catholic propaganda that's come down to us through the centuries, not least through books like Hollinger's Chronicles or John Fox's Acts and Monuments and so on. You start to get a very different picture. But Mary had to deal with somebody else, a man with whom she had several stand-up confrontations, and that's John Knox, the fiery Calvinist Scottish preacher who commanded... He was linked to Murray. Murray could keep him under check to some extent, but Knox was really a very powerful force among the Edinburgh Protestants. And Knox had written this book, which was published in 1558, called "The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women." Of course, the title says it all. It was a polemic. It was a polemic by a Calvinist against Marie de Guise in Scotland, because it was written, of course, before both Marie de Guise died and before Mary Tudor died. And it was a polemic against Mary Tudor, the Catholic Queen of England, who was Elizabeth I's half-sister. If you're near enough the front to actually read it off the slide, it just opens, pretty much as it continues. "To promote a woman to bear rule, superiority, dominion, or empire above any realm, nation, or city is repugnant to nature, contumely to God, a thing most contrarious to his revealed will and approved ordinance, and finally, it is the subversion of good order, of all equity and justice." And Knox was getting this from Calvin's Geneva. This was fairly standard stuff in Calvin's Geneva. Unfortunately for Knox, this came out and it was on sale on the streets of London just in the week that Elizabeth was becoming Queen of England. Now, the thing about this is that it has a line, it has a take, and the take is very simple, fairly elementary, which is that Catholic women rulers are tyrants, they are extremely dangerous, they should be removed, it's God's will that they should be removed, and they can be deposed. And you can do this essentially as the Jewish people did to both Athaliah in the Old Testament and to Jezebel. Women rulers who had flirted with idolatry and who were removed and the true religion restored and all of those things. But in fact, the crucial thing about them is that they were both assassinated. Knox justifies the assassination of a Catholic ruler really simply because of the reasons given there, that because she's a Catholic and therefore a Catholic woman ruler is essentially not just a tyrant, but someone who rules out of passion and not reason. Now, as I've said, when Knox, who, by the way, never wanted to go back to Scotland after he had left for Geneva and was waiting at Dieppe after Elizabeth came to the throne, he wanted to come back to England, live in London, and send his sons to Oxford or Cambridge. But he had to. Elizabeth wouldn't have him back. So he wrote a grovelling letter in which he said, actually, I didn't mean this to apply to a Protestant woman, because sometimes God calls extraordinary women like Deborah in the Old Testament to be the redeemer, the saviour, the protector of the church. And Elizabeth is such an extraordinary woman. To which Elizabeth replied, you can forget that for a game of soldiers. I'm not having any of that. I am not Queen of England by some sort of extraordinary right given to me by God. I am Queen of England by dynastic right. And even if I were to say that I'm Queen as an extraordinary woman, the dynastic right would still be out there and it would be somebody else's and not a mine. But in the course of this discussion, in fact, it's also in the book, Knox says that an extraordinary woman, who of course is a Protestant, not a Catholic, governs through reason and not from passion. That is the antithesis. And here, ladies and gentlemen, is the source of that great stereotype that has always plagued discussions of Elizabeth and Mary, and you can see it all over the internet and in many, many books. The stereotype that Elizabeth ruled from the head, whereas Mary ruled from the heart. What this goes back to is John Locke, and it's based entirely not on its sort of political ideas, but on religious sectarianism. And we will touch briefly in a moment on an episode where Elizabeth most definitely not rule from the head and did something as emotional and frankly silly as anything Mary was ever said to have done. Now, in England, Elizabeth has to deal with men too. On the left, Sir William Cecil, later Lord Burghley. He's been her backstairs fixer since 1548, even in her brother Edward VI's reign. He's been her steward, he's looked after her, he's protected her during Mary's reign. He's also protected the Protestant exiles who left in Mary Tudor's reign, the Catholic Mary Tudor's reign, and fled abroad. He's extremely pleased to get back into power once Elizabeth succeeds in 1558, and he is resolved that he will never, ever find himself on the wrong side of the politics and religion ever again, and that England will remain Protestant forever. This guy has what's pretty much close to a messianic zeal, that England is called to be Protestant, must remain Protestant. He's also got a guilty conscience because, like Elizabeth herself in Mary Tudor's reign, he conformed to Catholicism when it came to the push. He was forced by Mary Tudor to hold a special high mass at Wimbledon with all the special creams brought along the river from the city down to Richmond and taken along to Wimbledon. And Mary Tudor made sure that Channel 4 News had the cameras there so that it was broadcast worldwide to humiliate him. So he's a fixer, he's a mastermind, as we'll see. On the right, Robert Dudley, with Boy, his dog, that belongs to the Rothschilds. It's at Waddesdon. It's an absolutely glorious picture. It was painted by Stephen van der Merlen, and it has to be painted. And those symbols, which represent the fact that Leicester was made Earl of Leicester in 1584, have to be painted after the paintings, because Stephen de Merlin was dead in 1563, by the end of 1563. But there is Dudley in all his finery, on borrowed money, of course, with his dog, and whoever painted that must have seen the very famous painting of Charles V with his dog, or an engraving of it. But Robert Dudley is Elizabeth's favourite. He is the only man that Elizabeth ever truly loved. He's the only man that Elizabeth ever really seriously contemplated marrying, but of course at the time that she contemplated marrying him, he was married to someone else, and that was the problem, especially when that person then fell down an incredibly short flight of stairs at Cumnor Place near Oxford, where which was effectively a sort of forcible sort of care home, where this young wife of Robert Dudley, Amy Robsart, had been basically stuck. And he went to see her once a year in black clothes, because Elizabeth didn't want anything to happen between them. Elizabeth was not always she was not a very nice person for much of the time. But Dudley is a great man of influence at court, and Elizabeth will listen to Dudley. She has something on the go with Dudley. There was never anything emotional between Cecil and Elizabeth. It was pure business. But with Dudley, it's a mixture of emotion, but also business. Now, just to position Cecil, he had himself depicted. He drew that himself. He was something of an artist. That is his tomb, the design for his tomb at Stamford Church. He didn't die till 1598, but he drawn this in 1562. There he is, the Protestant chivalric knight, kneeling at the altar, or on the monument. And what does it say? What does the inscription say? Well, if you actually go there and take the photo, it says that his great achievement was to protect the Queen and the Queen's safety and the security of the state. And by that he meant, eventually he managed to get the head of the Queen of Scots cut off. Remember, Cecil, in Edward VI's reign, had been a chum of John Knox. They'd had dinner together, they knew each other. For the next 20 years, until Knox's death in Scotland, he's writing to Cecil every now and then. He writes to Cecil just 2 weeks before, Knox writes just 2 weeks before his own death, in what I call the Victor Meldrew letter, because it's written, as he says, with one foot in the grave. And he's still on about the same thing. You haven't killed the Queen of Scots next yet. You know, we need to get on with it. Cecil, by the way, could barely speak Mary's name. He called her SQ. He had to describe her by an acronym. It's always SQ, SQ, or the Scottish Queen, or the Queen of Scots. He can hardly bear to say Mary, Queen of Scots. And if you look on the right-hand side, I'd probably have to read it to you because it's in the 16th century handwriting. But there, in paragraph two, that begins, it's the second paragraph that begins finally. This is almost Cecil's manifesto, and it's written in 1559, 2 years before Mary even thinks of returning from France to Scotland. And it's almost like a script for what's going to happen in the next 25, 27 years. Finally, if the Queen, that is the Queen of Scots, shall be unwilling to this, and what the previous part of the document says is that Scotland shall be continued to rule by a council of 24 nobles, even if Mary returns from France. Mary will be queen only in name. It's the Protestant lords who are going to be effectively the de facto regents of Scotland, and Scotland isn't going to be a monarchy anymore. It's effectively going to be a bit of a republic, rather like Venice, with a titular doge as head, a titular ruler as head, rather than a queen. If the Queen shall be unwilling to this, it is likely she will, in respect of the greedy and tyrannous affection of France. Then it is apparent that Almighty God is pleased to transfer from her the rule of that kingdom for the weal of it. So this guy, I mean, this is a really appropriate place to be reading out something like that. I mean, this guy even thinks he knows the will of Almighty God. You know, it's the will of Almighty God that Mary, Queen of Scots, if she doesn't agree, essentially not to be a monarch anymore, but to basically defer to these 24 Protestant nobles, then she should be ousted or deposed. In many respects, that says everything you need to know about William Cecil and Mary, and indeed about William Cecil and Elizabeth, because Elizabeth did most definitely not think that. Elizabeth and Mary, as human beings, as queens, were both fully paid-up members of the Women Monarchs Trade Union. They were going to defend their rights and their duty and their honour against all comers. Now, if you're Mary and you come up with the idea of a pact, you need to seal the pact. And to seal the pact, you need a meeting. And Mary always believed that if she could meet her sister face to face, the two women could talk without all these ghastly politicos, all these ghastly men around them. They could reach a deal in a relatively short space of time and a very amicable, binding treaty, an amity, as it was called. And of course, Mary also believed that, you know, the succession might well be settled in her favour in terms of being the next rightful heir. And how did she know that it might be settled? Because William Maitland of Leffington, the guy who'd first come up with the idea of the pact, and then basically Mary had made it her own, Leffington went south in the summer of 1561 and met Elizabeth at the Summer Progress in East Anglia in the autumn of the late summer actually of 1561. Unfortunately, he wrote it all down. He kept a record of exactly what they had said. And what Elizabeth said was, yes, I absolutely recognise that Mary is the next one in line. She has the best possible claim, and no one else has a claim that can match it. She is the rightful heir. But I'm not going to say so in public, and I'm not going to recognise it, and I'm not going to name her, because I'm not going to name anybody. And Elizabeth had this, you might call it a superstition. I think actually that's quite misogynist, actually. I think actually she had a calculated view that to name a successor was going to actually be dangerous, because she's looking back to what happened in the 1550s. She's looking back to the contention, you know, the Jane Grey episode, Edward VI's, you know, device for the succession and so on, the troubles in Mary Tudor's reign. She also makes this remark, which actually was put straight into the film, that no one can underestimate the inestimable, she said, cupidity. But actually that was changed to ambition, because it makes it easier, you know, for people to understand it in, you know, in the Midwest, essentially the Midwest of America, who don't know necessarily what cupidity is without a dictionary. No one can underestimate the insatiable cupidity of men. So she wasn't going to name anyone. So it isn't that she doesn't recognise Mary, it's just that she's not going to name her. But of course Mary is looking to be named. But anyway, this meeting is arranged, and it really was arranged. You know, one of the things I'm most often asked is, did they ever really meet? And they came so close in 1562, because they both wanted it. The person who didn't want it was William Cecil. He thought that if they met, they might actually settle their differences and basically cut things up so that Mary might, the Catholic Queen, might actually succeed. Because remember, Elizabeth settles the throne on the basis of dynasty, not a religious test. That's the difference. So, it's all agreed that they're going to meet. First, it was going to be either at Nottingham or York, and then it's settled that it's going to be at York. They'd even hired the 16th century equivalent of Travelex UK to set up the exchange booths where people could exchange their Scottish money for English money. All the food and drink had been ordered. Everything was set. And then the French Wars of Religion broke out in France. And the French Wars of Religion began when Mary's uncle, the Duke of Guise, was leading his forces through the village of Vassy in eastern side of France. His troops heard a bunch of Huguenot worshipping, singing psalms in a barn, and they went in and Huguenot, over 100 were injured, and I think 20 or so were killed. And Cecil used this as a reason to cancel the meeting. You can't have a meeting with someone whose uncle's just murdered Protestants in France. It's absolutely unacceptable. And Elizabeth agreed with that. The only problem is, Cecil had already written the press release cancelling the meeting 2 weeks before the massacre at Vassy. He was determined that this should be cancelled, and this is one of his preliminary documents, long before the massacre, which he's worked up in his private papers. The great thing about William Cecil, if you're a historian, people here from the National Archives will know this very well, was that this guy sat up late at night till 2 in the morning writing memos to himself. So you can actually do in history with Cecil what you can only do otherwise for most people if you're a biographer in fiction. You can look inside his head and see what he was thinking almost day by day. And Cecil wrote, "The affairs in France remain not only uncompounded, but by bloodshed on both parts likely to increase." He was expecting something nasty to happen, and it did. And secondly, "The desire that the Queen of Scots hath to meet with the Queen's Majesty is to be intended chiefly for her own profit. It may be thought that by her journey she will insinuate herself to some sorts of people of this realm to further her claim, and shall give occasion to such people as love change." They still talk that way over the road. You want to stop something. These are the sort of classic sort of ways that you're going to stop it. And that's our guy, William Cecil. He's much more than Elizabeth's bureaucrat minister, much, much more than that. But he knew how to be a bureaucrat when it counted. Now, they don't have the meeting. What's the next best way that you can control an independent woman, a woman who knows her own mind, in the 16th century? How do you deal with a troublesome woman? You marry her off to a bloke who's under your thumb. Because, of course, in the 16th century, gender kicks in. Gender assumptions, the 16th century was not an age of equal opportunities. In England, for example, if a woman married a man, she lost her legal identity. All her money was her husband's, her lands were her husband's, and all of this, except in very exceptional circumstances. So, the idea is we should now try and get Mary married off to someone that we trust. And this idea is sold to Elizabeth, who then thinks it's actually quite a good idea. And who do they pick? Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, by then. He's made Earl of Leicester, actually, so he's of a sufficient title, perhaps, to marry Mary, Queen of Scots. And when Mary, says, why on earth do they think I'm going to marry Elizabeth's cast-off lover? Actually, he wasn't quite cast off, but, you take her point. And she actually says to the English ambassador, Thomas Randolph, how does it stand with my honour to marry my sister's subject, which is in the film and is actually straight out of the documents? What a line which Saoirse Ronan delivers, with all her characteristic aplomb. Actually, no one was more relieved than Robert Dudley that she decided not to marry him. He was her friend forever afterwards, I have to say. And by the way, you're in the 16th century. Dudley, Elizabeth's, counsellor, favourite, he keeps on writing to Mary, Queen of Scots. He meets her later when she's in England at the baths at Buxton, at the springs at Buxton. He keeps in touch with her because you never know. She might really be Elizabeth might pop her clogs. And she really might be the next one. You keep in touch. But anyway, Mary goes her own way and she meets Henry Darnley, who's actually, despite what they tell you on the TV, by nationality, he's officially English. He's not Scottish, although he does have also Scottish as well as English descent. He is as tall as Mary. They're of pretty similar height. They're both about 6 foot one, something like that. Mary is certainly 6 feet tall. It was remarkable for the 16th century. He's handsome. He's gallant. He's, as it turns out, quite a nasty piece of work. He's probably already got syphilis when he actually goes up to Scotland and meets Mary. He's pretty effeminate. He's drunk. He's a drunkard. He's a bit of a sexual predator. His nickname was the Great Cock Chick, and the pun was intentional. However, especially ladies and female students here, you will meet guys like this all your life. He was one of these guys who knew how to behave until the ring was on the finger. He could behave for 3 to 6 months, and that's exactly what he did. Mary thought she was in love with him. It's a great picture, that. It's at Hardwick Hall, which is now a National Trust property. But she marries him. He's also got a claim to the throne because he's descended from Margaret Tudor, Henry the Seventh's elder daughter, amongst other things. And so Mary is tightening her claim to the English throne by marrying him as well as finding a husband. Now, there's two things happening here. Not only is she tightening her claim to the throne of England, given that Elizabeth isn't recognising her as the next heir, but also she's doing what a queen ought to do, a dynastic monarch ought to do. She's marrying, planning to have a child, and settling the succession in her own country. And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, when this marriage was announced and when it took place, William Cecil was practically shaking in his shoes. He writes a memo, which is in the National Archives, in which he says, the people of England will flock to her because she's done what a queen ought to do. She's done what our own queen ought to do. She's marrying and she's going to have an heir. And what's more, the people of England will flock to her, whether Catholic or Protestant, because dynastic security, when push comes to shove, is going to count more than the settlement of religion. So this is, you know, this is a dangerous moment. Trouble is that once Darnley is married, once the ring is on the finger, he demands to be king. Actually, he demanded to be king a few days before. And actually, one of Mary's mistakes was to say that he could be, and then she began to have second thoughts and realise what he was like very soon after the wedding. And she said, no, I think I'm just going to make you a duke. And this is the source of the friction that now emerges between them, virtually from the beginning. Remember, gender is kicking in here. If you know anything about Lady Jane Grey, you will know that in 1956, a manuscript fell out of a drawer in the Escorial, Philip II's palace just outside Madrid, which had a report from a Venetian cardinal, Commendoni, who was sent to England at the beginning of Mary Tudor's reign to report for the Pope on what was happening in England. And because he's Venetian, he's not Roman, he's Venetian, he stays at the Venetian embassy and he talks to people who were there and saw it all. And they say that as soon as Jane Grey was proclaimed queen, her new husband, Guildford Dudley, turned up and said, well, that's good stuff because now I'm the king. And Jane Grey, being a woman of spirit, said, no, you're not. The most I'm going to do is make you a duke. To which, according to this manuscript, Guildford Dudley then says, well, I'm on a sex strike. No sex, no heir. You're in trouble. At which point he has to be taken off and given a stiff drink by the Earls of Arundel and Pembroke. Now, the point about this, you see, though, is that you can see the gender issue kicking in. And there is no better case than this. But also, of course, Darnley was a threat to Murray, to Maitland, and to the other Scottish lords. Murray was totally against this marriage. The reason that he gave officially was that Darnley was too effeminate. He wasn't masculine enough. But of course, the reason really is that once Darnley is there, he's going to nudge out these other established councillors. And maybe he really will become king. At which point, Mary gets on her horse. Murray leads a rebellion, at which point Mary gets on her horse. There's no slide for this, but she gets on her horse, and as the English ambassador reports, she puts on a steel cap with a gun in her holster. She rides astride the horse, which, of course, was not protocol in the 6th century. Women rode the horse side saddle, and she leads her army into battle, and this really happened. And all those people who, you know, wrote to newspapers or Googled and whatever and said that the idea of Mary was a warrior queen was completely unhistorical, were talking through their hats. That criticism is completely codswallop and fatuous. Mary, you know, that would be the breastplate, the sort of armour she'd put on, the steel cap, you know, etc. Whether she fired the gun, I really couldn't say. But she certainly had the pistol in her holster. And Knox, look at the quote at the bottom. John Knox admired her for this so much, even though she was actually clobbering the guy who was the leader of his own side, said, albeit the most part wax weary, yet the Queen's courage increased manlike. You know, you love that. You just love the gender point. Increased manlike so that she was ever with the foremost. So Murray is driven out of England, out of Scotland, and he flees to England. He's in exile now in England with many of his supporters. And Mary is triumphant, but of course this is only the beginning of her troubles, because Mary then decides that those rebels are going to forfeit their lands, and she summons a parliament at which forfeitures will take place, and Murray will be stripped of his lands and possibly even of his titles and those around him. Darnley, meanwhile, is sulking because he wants to be king. And in addition to that, Darnley is jealous of this Savoyard, originally musician, but also secretary, David Rizzio, who came to see Mary's coronation as the secretary of the Duke of Savoy's ambassador, but stayed in Scotland and eventually becomes Mary's secretary. And Darnley's father, who is on the left here, Matthew Stuart, Earl of Lennox, we're in Scotland, remember, conjures up this conspiracy, this plot, by which those lords who essentially want Murray and those of his supporters to be restored to their lands work out a plot, largely with Lennox, whereby in return they will agree that Darnley will be king. He will then either cancel the parliament or cancel the prescription which takes away the lands. And also, as part of the deal, Darnley, who doesn't like Rizzio and wants rid of him, will get Rizzio murdered. And they all seal what's known in Scotland as a bond of Manrin, which is literally signed, you know, practically in blood. It's a blood feud. This is what they're going to do. And they all sign it, and Darnley signs it. And in fact, the plot takes place. Rizzio is murdered. He's murdered actually in Mary's, just outside her supper room, in the main chamber at Holyrood on the first floor. If you go to Holyrood, they'll still show you the blood stain on the floor, even though the floor was stripped and revarnished in the 19th century and the building restored. But nonetheless, it's all good for business. But Rizzio is dragged out of the supper room where he's there with a number of Mary's close friends having dinner. He's dragged away and he's taken away and he's actually stabbed 57 times by everybody who's signed this bond. It's an absolutely bloody night. She's pregnant. And in the course of this, when she stands up to try and interpose herself between the assassins and Rizzio, Andrew Carr of Fordenside points a gun to her belly, and of course she's pregnant. This is an incredible thing to happen to a queen, this is the sort of thing that happens in Scotland. Mary rises above all this. She escapes, she regroups, and she has her baby in Edinburgh Castle, not in Holyrood. She has it under guard in one of the most secure parts of Edinburgh Castle. And just to go back to this for a moment, William Cecil had 2 weeks' notice that Rizzio was going to be murdered. Actually, if you're an archive person, I know there are some people here, this is really interesting, because there's a letter that everybody... Sometimes really important things are hidden in plain sight in archives. It's not just finding new things. There's a letter that Elizabeth wrote to Mary shortly before Rizzio's murder in 1566. She was fed up with Murray being a cuckoo in her nest. She wanted rid of him out of the country. Basically, Cecil drafts the letter and Elizabeth signs it. And it's sent up to Scotland, addressed to Mary. It's a beautiful document. It's absolutely spectacular. It's in the National Archives in Kew. And it says, I need you to take Murray back. I want rid of him, basically. Do me this favour. Okay. Well, that's quite interesting, but nothing to report, is it? But, see, I was a student of Geoffrey Elton, the great Tudor historian who understood, like art experts do now, that you need to know not just what the document says, but what's its provenance. What's it doing in the National Archives in London? Well, I researched that, and what did I find? It was sent up, it was sealed. It was sent up the Great North Road. It got to Berwick. And when it got to Berwick, they said, oh, send that back to London. You're not going to need that. Somehow they knew what was inside these letters, even they were sealed. Because Rizzio is going to be murdered next week and all hell will break out. So it goes back to Cecil. He knows that Rizzio is going to be murdered. He doesn't tell Elizabeth. Why? Because she'll intervene. She'll tip Mary off. Such are the convolutions of Tudor politics. But Mary has her baby. And in many respects, she's now at the height of her powers. She's a married queen who's had an heir to the throne. Yes? Except that in Scotland, this could also be a weakness, because what is very common in Scotland? Regencies by male nobles in favour of minors. Now is the chance that maybe Mary could be ousted and these nobles could rule Scotland for the next 20-odd years as regents, as a committee of 24 nobles for Prince James. So it's on a knife edge. But Mary thinks this birth is a moment of great triumph, and she organises the baptism at Stirling. It's the most spectacular fete seen essentially anywhere in Europe for many years, and probably one of the two great spectacular fetes. It costs an arm and a leg. Remember that Mary is actually able to fund things because she's a Dowager Queen of France, and the French actually are actually paying her pension on a regular basis, so she is actually independently wealthy. But she organises this baptism as a great fete of reconciliation. The nobles are to be recognised, to be reconciled. Feuding is to end, and Elizabeth sends a gift. And that gift is a solid gold font for the baptism, which weighs 333 ounces of solid metal, or 21 pounds. I've said this many, many times, but I was just thinking actually on the bus as I was coming down Whitehall on the way to give this talk, that must be the most generous and expensive gift that Elizabeth ever gave to anybody in her entire life. Elizabeth was notoriously mean. This is an extraordinary gift. And why does Elizabeth give this generous gift? Because 6 weeks before, Mary had had a burst gastric ulcer and was lying practically in fear of death at Jedburgh in the Scottish borderlands. And she had made a will. And in that will, she said that should she die, Elizabeth should be James's basically surrogate mother. Her sister should be the surrogate mother. She wasn't just to be the godparent. And James was to live with Elizabeth in England. And Elizabeth, who did occasionally have a human soul, was so touched by this that she was willing to reopen the succession question again. She was willing to open the possibility that Mary might indeed become her next heir, or at least she was willing to open it to the point where she was willing to refer Henry VIII's will, which had settled the whole business of the future succession of the British monarchies, to the judges, the English judges, to see whether it was lawful. In Henry VIII's will, the succession had passed from Henry to Edward to Mary Tudor to Elizabeth. But the Scots were sort of not exactly left out, but they were competing with others like Lady Frances Brandon and the Jane Grey dynasty, the Suffolk dynasty, to be Henry's lawful heir. But of course, was the will signed? The will, the statute which said Henry could leave the throne by will, by designation by will, the will had to be signed by the king, and everybody knew that it wasn't signed by the king. Go and look at it in the National Archives. It's signed with a stamp, and it's almost certainly signed posthumously with a dry stamp and then inked in. And Mary knew that if the judges of England were shown that will, she was on a winning ticket, because most of the judges in England were Catholics and would have supported Mary in any case. So Mary, at the time of this, just after this this reconciliation at Stirling and so on, or this ostensible reconciliation, she's talking to Elizabeth, she's reconciling her nobles. She does also something which was incredibly generous. She could be too generous, she could be too trusting, but was also, it turned out, to be extremely dangerous, inadvertently. Cecil had basically ordered the special ambassador, the Earl of Bedford, who went to the baptism, to plead with Mary to allow that those who'd murdered Rizzio be allowed to come back to Scotland out of exile in England. And they included the Earl of Morton, James Douglas, Earl of Morton, who was a very, very dangerous man. And that turned out, for a reason you'll see in a moment, was to be a mistake. But at the end of January 1567, it's very, very clear that a deal is about to be struck potentially between these two sister queens over the succession, and that James, you know, is basically going to be brought up by his mother, and Darnley is going to be marginalised and all of those things. Darnley, of course, is a problem because he's plotting, demanding to be king and threatening to abduct James and take him abroad. Well, the nobles then take things into their own hands, because the minute the Earl of Morton and those people who've been chucked out to England after the Rizzio plot get back to England, remember that Darnley had signed a bond practically in blood, and he dishonoured that bond, and so they kill him. They kill him in the first British gunpowder plot at Kirkafield in February 1567, and this is a narrative history painting. In the 16th century, it's not like a snapshot. It's like a movie, but it's all in the one still. So here is, there's the explosion. There's the explosion, the house blowing up on the left. Darnley is fleeing across the wall into the nearby garden where he's strangled. Then basically he's being buried down below. The body's being taken away. And there is Prince James pleading for revenge for the people who killed his father. This is commissioned, of course, by the Lennoxes, by Darnley's family, and it's a propagandist piece. But nonetheless, you know, Scotland is now in serious trouble. And Mary, you know, if you kill... This is a regicide. You had killed what Catholics believed to be a king. So Mary's in trouble. And how did this happen? Well, there's the Earl of Morton on the right-hand side. And I'm sure Murray knew about it, because he knew not to be there on the night. He knew to be on the other side of the Firth of Forth on the night. But the main orchestrator of this is the Earl of Morton. But the hatchet man that does the business is James Hepburn, Earl of Bothwell. And then events take on a life of their own. I mean, Mary had coped incredibly well up to this point. They kill her secretary. She gets over it. She has her baby. They kill her husband in a gunpowder plot. You know, I mean, the woman's, you know, is she friendless? She's certainly emotionally distraught. She's in pieces. I mean, she is, you know, I mean, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, you might attribute to her. And this guy exploits it, and she listens to him because he goes to her. She doesn't know that he's been involved with this plot as such, but he goes to her and offers to be her protector. And she accepts that. Why? Because he's solvent, and two, he can raise an army, and two, he's had a track record all the way along, right from the beginning, of being the protector of Marie de Guise. He's the original Scottish nationalist because he's pro-French and anti-English. And when Cecil, without Elizabeth's knowledge, helped the rebel lords of the congregation in 1559 to attempt to depose Mary's mother and impose a Protestant reformation on Scotland, Cecil covertly sent them £3,000 in English gold, an untraceable English gold, across the border, and Bothwell stole it. So they want this guy's blood. But Mary takes him as her protector, but then he does what all people do, certainly in Scotland, in this situation. He then demands to marry Mary as the price of protection. And then it all starts again, because now the lords turn on him. There are two versions of how he is. Simplest, just to say that Bothwell said he insisted on marrying Mary but wouldn't take no for an answer, because there are two routes to deciding how he actually enforced this on Mary. One is by raping her, which some historians go with, and the other one, which I go with, is coercive psychological control. But either way, he got Mary to marry him, and then it all starts all over again. And then they want rid of Bothwell. They now drag Mary into a sex scandal. Now Mary supposedly knew all about Darnley's murder ahead. She was supposedly sleeping with Bothwell, you know, for months, if not years, before the murder. She'd been sleeping with him allegedly for, you know, 2 years before Darnley ever got murdered. They give dates and places. It's like the charges against Anne Boleyn in 1536. You look them up. They're all fictitious. It never happened. But people, you know, mud sticks, people believe it. And placards were stuck up in Edinburgh, posted up by the Lennoxes, that's Darnley's father, who want their revenge. Mary now suddenly is turned into a femme fatale. an adulteress, a sex siren who lures victims to their fate. Bothwell's depicted as a hare, lust and cowardice, and so on. They then force Mary to abdicate. Imagine that. She's taken to Lochleven. She's put on that island fortress. Just really not far north. If you're driving up from Edinburgh over the Firth of Forth, over the Forth Bridge, and just going north towards Perth, you know, it's the right turn, about 10 miles along. She's taken to Lochleven. She's forced to abdicate. She very reluctantly, under pressure, signs the abdication document. Now, what about Elizabeth? Elizabeth was shocked that Darnley was murdered because Darnley was one of her cousins. But she was even more shocked that an anointed queen had been forced to abdicate. This, she said, was much more terrible. It was a much more dangerous thing than Darnley's murder, whoever had done it. She sends Nicholas Throckmorton, who's the sort of Tudor Henry Kissinger, up to Scotland. Elizabeth gives instructions to Throckmorton. He's to get Mary out. She's to be restored as queen. She's to have her money back. These nobles are to be, basically brought to heel. This absolutely has to happen. Mary had got a letter out. She got a letter out to Throckmorton after he'd arrived in Scotland. There it is. It was rolled up, secreted away. It's on the left-hand side. It basically says, "I'm a celebrity. Get me out of here." Just as Throckmorton is about to leave London and go up to Scotland, Cecil sends for him. He gives him counter-instructions. And those counter-instructions, you can still see the draft in the National Archives. She's not to be got out, she's to be left in. If she's left out, she's to be a queen only in name. She's not to have any money. Scotland's to be ruled by a council of 24 nobles. What was in the original script. Throckmorton can't do that. It actually destroys his career because he can't please them both, but he can't tell the other one that basically he's got these other orders. But what I want to draw to your attention is not the detail of that, but that this bit on the right here, if I could just get to it there. You probably can't read it here from this distance, but I can see it. And this was this was what I always regarded as my eureka moment, although I've got a surprise for you a little bit just in a couple of minutes. There's been a bigger eureka moment. But this was my eureka moment. Athalia for reg, interrempta per Joash regem. Athalia was assassinated so that Joash could be king for reg. In the 16th century, there were not two books of chronicles, four books of kings. There were two books of kings and two books of chronicles. Look it up. It's the very same reference to the assassination of Athalia that Knox uses in the first blast of the trumpet. Athalia was assassinated so that Joash could be king. And of course, Joash then ruled with godly nobles until he came of age. And then, and meanwhile, the true religion and so on and was restored, and idols were banished and all of that. That is Cecil seeing the hand of God in history. And it shows him he's just waiting now for Mary to be killed. Somehow she's got to be killed. And it's also that the conceptual link, that apart from the fact they're writing letters to each other, which links Knox and Cecil so very, very closely. And Mary gets out of prison. She escapes. She raises an army. She's really unlucky. She loses the Battle of Langside. And she probably makes her only really very big mistake. She flees to England. Rather than trying to muster new forces and start all over again, she flees to England and throws herself on Elizabeth's mercy. She asks for a meeting. Elizabeth considers it. She doesn't even get the chance to finish considering it because Cecil's already written and got Mary locked up. He's acted independently. Mary is now brought into Carlisle Castle, and she stays a prisoner in England for the next 19 years. But Mary still wants a meeting. And she's in 1570... She writes a humble letter. She basically swallows her pride and writes a grovelling letter to Cecil asking that she could meet Elizabeth. Interestingly, she did meet Cecil. She wanted to meet somebody, and actually Cecil says, I'll have to go because I'm the only person she's not going to win over. And they did briefly meet. And then Cecil wants to get, he wants an end brought to this. He wants Mary to be essentially executed for, tried and executed for the crimes done allegedly by her in Scotland, and the counsel for the prosecution, rather like the Trump impeachment, the prosecutors are going to be the Scottish nobles who are going to come up and present this evidence. I'm sort of glossing over things a little bit here now. Elizabeth actually didn't think that Mary had done anything. She wasn't sure, but she certainly didn't want action to be taken against Mary. Cecil goes it alone. This thing appears, which everybody thought was written by George Buchanan and was published in Edinburgh. Well, it never was. The title tells you all you need to know. A detection of the doings of Marie, Queen of Scots, touching the murder of her husband and her conspiracy, adultery, and pretended marriage with the Earl of Bothwell. This is what I call the sexed up dossier, the original sexed up dossier. It was originally written in manuscript for the Earl of Lennox by George Buchanan, but George Buchanan threw up his hands and said he had no connection with this, and he didn't, because this was not published in Edinburgh. It was published in London by John Day, who was Cecil's tame printer, and it was turned, the dossier was turned, even more incriminatingly, into Foley Scots, by Thomas Wilson, who was one of Cecil's cronies. This is the first bit of conspiratorial, what word do you want to use? This is politics at its most brutal. And it's published on the eve of the 1572 Parliament, which Cecil tries to get Mary executed. And it's almost certainly put into brown envelopes and given to all Cecil's assured friends on the eve of the Parliament, because they quote from it in the debates. But Elizabeth won't do anything, because remember, Elizabeth actually thinks that the most important thing in all of this story is the protection, even sanctity, of the ideal of monarchy. Mary is the lawful anointed queen. She may have made mistakes, she may even have committed crimes, but if so, she's accountable to God and not to men. And this goes on. Now, as everybody knows, the great question is, were they going to meet? Did they meet? In the film they meet, because in theatre you have to have the two protagonists meeting. And I knew all along about this. This is a world first. You have not seen this. This has never been seen in public since 1762. It's taken me ages and ages to get a photocopy. I first saw it in 2010 when it disappeared. It had disappeared in 1762 with 42 other documents because they were ripped out of the Sadler papers. Ralph Sadler was Elizabeth's last but one, was Mary Queen of Scots' last but one jailer. We don't need all those details. But in the Sadler papers, you can go to the Sadler papers, and in this volume, there's a lot of pages being ripped out. You can see the string. And I went down to, Sotheby's called me up, and I went down to 2010, and you know, this is the letter that I always knew had to exist. It isn't my book, because my book was written long before this letter appeared. It is mentioned in my Elizabeth of Forgotten Years of 2015, because I'd seen it by then, but I wasn't allowed to have an image. But I had seen it in Sotheby's, in Bond Street, in 2010. No notes, no pack drill, you have to remember it, because it's become commercial property. It's sold for £250,000 to an American, to a British collector who's a multi-millions entrepreneur in America. It's the letter that had to exist. You can even see, when I saw it in Sotheby's, you can even see the string that matches the string from the Sadler papers. It's a quite extraordinary thing. But here we go. This is the letter in which Elizabeth writes in 1584, at the time of the Bond of Association, when everybody else is trying to think of how to kill Mary, if she plots. For she herself knoweth how great contentment, this is written to Sadler to be read to Mary, for she herself knoweth how great contentment and liking we had for a time of her friendship, which as we then esteemed as a singular and extraordinary blessing of God, to have one so nearly tied unto us in blood and neighbourhood, so greatly affected towards us as we then conceived, so are we now as much grieved to behold the alteration and interruption thereof. So Mary shall send one of her secretaries to acquaint us with such matter as she shall think meet by him to impart to us. He was to bring with him such proposals as might work upon good ground, a thorough reconciliation between us. Well, I think that's an absolutely extraordinary find. I always knew it had to exist, because I always knew that what mattered to Elizabeth was as much as to Mary the ideal of monarchy, and that the ideal of monarchy should not be attenuated by any sort of public trial or any sort of, you know, attempt to accuse her of treason or execute or any sort of stuff of that sort. And what Elizabeth in her heart yearned for, as much as for as Mary, was a reconciliation. You know, just 2 years really before Cecil's writing Mary's death warrant, Elizabeth can. And of course, this explains entirely why Elizabeth was so reluctant to sign the warrant, why when she signed the warrant she called it back and all of that. But feast your eyes on that, because you will see it again in public. It's going to be one of the centrepieces it's going to be loaned to the British Library. There's going to be a mega exhibition on Elizabeth and Mary at the British Library starting in October and running until February, for which I've just written the introduction to the catalogue. I have to say that the British Library now call this the John Guy letter, because it's the letter that I always said had to exist. Right, okay. And Mary is not plotting until 1586 at the time of the Babington plot. Why is she not plotting? Because it's in 1586 that Elizabeth ratifies a treaty with James, Mary's son, recognising James as the true King of Scotland, and ousting Mary from the equation. After all those years, it's taken Elizabeth all those years to sort of come over to this, but she finally recognises James as the true King of Scotland, at which point Mary says, right, I've been locked up for nearly 19 years. I've been deprived of my throne. I want to get out of here, and I want to get out of here by whatever means offer themselves to me. I am not Elizabeth's subject. I cannot commit treason against her. I'm a sovereign prince. Under international law, if I escape and Elizabeth happens to get killed, that's God's providence. That's her argument. I'm not defending it, but it's an argument, and you could probably find a very good QC in the 16th century in international law to put that to a court. I mean, naturally, they tried to trap her. They intercept her correspondence, they get hold of her cipher. This guy, Sir Francis Walsingham, Cecil's right-hand man and the man conventionally known as Elizabeth's spymaster, knows all about Anthony Babington and his so-called plot. You think the Babington plot was a plot by Babington? Forget it. I mean, Babington was a rich Catholic playboy with more money than sense in the 1580s. Who thinks that he might, you know, it might be quite a good wheeze to liberate Mary, Queen of Scots. And basically, Walsingham's people stiffen up Babington, coach him. Basically, this is called a projection, where you actually create, you use, you know, an idea or somebody else's fancy to conjure a plot that you can then discover. And then basically wreak vengeance on those who've been associated with it. So Mary is drawn into this plot. Yes, she did write the letter. Yes, she did endorse Babington. Yes, all of those things, because she believed now that she had to absolutely get out of there. And of course, they catch her. She's put on trial. She's convicted. Elizabeth is unbelievably reluctant to sign the warrant. How does Cecil get Elizabeth to sign the death warrant? He tells her that in 1587... he tells her the Spanish Armadas arrived in Wales a year early. She should double her bodyguards. It's an incredible lie. He and Walsingham, Cecil and Walsingham, go to the French ambassador, and basically they do a deal. They've caught the French ambassador out, and they blackmail him into conniving with them, into reviving an old plot, which they pretend is a current one, also to threaten Elizabeth, and she's told, as I say, to double her bodyguards. She signs the warrant. The next day she calls for it back. She wants it back. She tells her secretary not to do anything with it for the moment until she's ready. Cecil calls a meeting of selected privy councillors, those who want Mary dead. He calls it clandestinely in his own private chamber. He coaxes them into sending Robert Beale, one of the Privy Council clerks, with the warrant to Fotheringay regardless. The proceedings were to be kept very secret and were justified as for Elizabeth's special service tending to the safety of her royal person and the universal quietness of her whole realm. Elizabeth is to know nothing until Mary was dead, until, as they put it, the deed was done. And then they all signed this. They all signed this paper, which was discovered. It got out into private hands. It was actually in the possession of the Earl of Kent, and his descendants gave it to Archbishop Laud, and it was seized from Archbishop Laud's study on the eve of the Civil War. On the second attempt, Lambeth Palace Library managed to buy it, the second attempt in auction. They lost out the first time, but they got it the second time. That is a remarkable document, because that is effectively a Republican document in which the Privy Council overrule, bypass the monarch anyway. They've been told not to send this, to hold off with this warrant. She has signed it, but they're told to hold off. They sign this and they get it sent off. And the first thing that Elizabeth knows about this is when the bells in London are ringing, and she comes back in from meeting an ambassador and suddenly discovers that the Queen of Scots is dead. Okay, now, I've probably spoken for a little bit too long, but never mind. Just three very fast things. Okay, we've had a lot of detail here. What's the big picture? What's the big picture? In the 16th century, number one, in the 16th century, if you're a woman ruler, what are you going to do about marriage? Elizabeth and Mary did it different ways. If you marry, you're damned, as Mary, Queen of Scots, did, because your husband demands to be king, and then you finish up in a sex scandal. If you don't marry, you hold off like Elizabeth did, your dynasty dies with you, because you have no heir. And, you know, I mean, you can never really maintain a totally stable state, because without the security of knowing what's going to happen in the future. You know, people ask me in college, in Clare, they come for supervision and say, what did the Elizabethan religious settlement actually settle? And I've begun to say, well, how could it settle anything until you settle the succession first? It was always going to be, to some degree, in contention. Secondly, women rulers in the 16th century, even if you were as steely as Elizabeth, are vulnerable. They are vulnerable to what you might call the gender issue, to that element of male DNA in the 16th century that just automatically assumes that basically this is the world in which men rule, and that women are in somehow subordinate to the men. And thirdly, something really quite cosmic happened in British history between the death of Henry VIII and 1603, because Henry VIII is something fairly close to what you might think within the frame of reference of the time an absolute monarch might be. So is Francis I. Now, you know, 100 and odd years later, you've got Louis XIV in France, l'état savoir, an absolute monarchy. In England in 1649, you've got Charles I, who gets his head chopped off. Both James I, when he came to England, and Charles I, could never understand why they couldn't rule like Henry VIII, you know, in Charles's case, in prose, a pair book on Scotland, or all of those things. And the answer is that when on Henry VIII's death, you had first minority rule, a little boy, and then you had female rule. And in that 50 years, that 50, 60 years, the culture changed. The men infiltrated through councils, through parliaments, the expectation that this was going to be a different sort of monarchy. Something on the, if you like, the first stage towards the glorious revolution of 1688, you know, to the 19th century, and the sort of monarchy that we have got now. And if you think that that's Whiggish, that's absolutely fine, because maybe the Whigs were right. Thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, friends, if you've heard John speak before, you will recognise that vintage brilliance and the gifts of an expert storyteller. If you have seen him live before, you will also recognise the rich, thorough, detailed academic presentation, which is itself such a masterful navigation, not just of the relationship between these two extraordinary early modern women, but the relationship also of the people at the sides, the people pulling the strings, the people trying to tug, as it were, the set towards them. John, we are massively in your debt. Dr. Guy has very kindly agreed to take some questions, and we've got a few minutes now. Who would like to kick us off with a question? Just over there.
So you're talking a lot about Cecil and how he was able to give orders even though he was under the monarch. How was that possible? I mean, I know that you did kind of explain it a lot, but why did the Queen never limit Cecil's power and reassert her authority over him?
Great question. Why didn't she sack him if she knew that this was going on? Fantastic question. This cuts to the heart of, if you're a woman monarch, you need someone who's on your side. Now, on all other issues, those two could work together. The issue that always basically was this problem was Mary, because it touched on religion and monarchy and brought those to get together. And so actually, it's not like a two-way relationship between Elizabeth and Mary. It's a sort of triangulated relationship between Elizabeth, Mary, and Cecil. I think there are actually two parts to the answer. One is that Elizabeth needed somebody on her side. Cecil was on her side, even if he was on her side too much. You know, he really did believe that he needed to kill Mary in order to protect Elizabeth's safety. But also, I think there's a little bit more to it. They'd gone back a long way. She was dependent on him. You work with the people that you know. They also, frankly, had something on each other. They both knew they would conform to Catholicism in Mary Tudor's reign, and they were ashamed and embarrassed about it, and they wanted that kept absolutely dark. But the second part, if you like, the last part, is that, of course, the story continues after Mary's death. When Elizabeth found out what they'd done, she absolutely gave Cecil the bollocking of his life and all of those who'd been involved in it. Walsingham was, you know, almost marginalised. She didn't care when, you know, he died shortly afterwards. There was no respect for him, you know, at the funeral or anything from her. William Davison, the secretary who'd let the warrant out of his possession to Cecil, was sent to the Tower. He was sacked from his jobs. Basically, you know, he did sort of get back in the sense that he was allowed to keep some salary, which Cecil arranged. But he wasn't allowed to hold a position again. But with Cecil, who by then is Lord Burghley, Elizabeth won't speak to him for 6 months. She tells him that she would basically have sent him to the Tower if he hadn't been unwell, and, you know, sort of getting on a bit. And also, in order to clear his name in the Star Chamber proceedings, Cecil has to commit perjury in an affidavit, a sworn affidavit, to the Court of Star Chamber, in which he says that Davison said that the Queen had said that he could send the warrant, and it was a lie. So actually, I wrote another book, 2015, called Elizabeth of Forgotten Years, and it more or less starts with this. Because this is the moment, Elizabeth's reaction to this is the moment when she actually, if you like, liberates herself from the sort of tentacles that these men have built around her. And it coincides with really two things. One is the war with Spain, which obviously gives the monarch a lot more power, and on the whole, governments tend to come together in wartime. But also, secondly, by then, indeed by 1584, neither women nor men knew a great deal about female gynaecology in the 16th century, but everybody knew that once you were over 50, and certainly by 53, 55, a woman had passed the menopause. So there was absolutely no point badgering Elizabeth all the time to marry or do all those things, because there was no point. They now were stuck with the whole fact that she really was a virgin queen, and they just had to make the best of it. So in some ways, this, you know, for Elizabeth, it's catastrophic, because it does attenuate the ideal of monarchy. You couldn't have cut off Charles I's head in the way that it was done without, first of all, cutting off his grandmother's.
Thank you very much. Next question.
Another question?
I think you mentioned, I perhaps missed a point afterwards, but you said Elizabeth did the silliest thing she ever did. And I'm not at some stage, and I didn't quite pick up what that was.
The silliest thing she ever did, I think, was putting up Robert Dudley as a husband for Mary. There's absolutely no way. I think there's more to it than that. Actually, I'm really sorry for going over my time. It sort of does tend to happen on these occasions, but I could have said quite a bit more about that, because it wasn't just that she thought that Robert Dudley should marry Mary. It was that they should then move south and stay at Elizabeth's palaces as in a ménage à trois. They should all live together as a happy family. And Elizabeth talks together a bit. She does use the phrase, you know, as a happy family. You know, I mean, how real is that? Is that governing from the head as opposed to from the heart? Elizabeth did a lot of silly things. Mary did some silly things. My desire is that these two women should be looked at on a level playing field. And that means going to archives. And it basically means actually finding out what these women did, what they said, as far as the best as you can do, what they thought. And I mean, remember that propaganda tract that had been written by Buchanan in the sort of sexed up dossier that Cecil then sort of makes official and publishes. I mean, that was used to write history.
Yeah. Have we got any other questions? Anybody else like to ask John a question? Whilst you're thinking, I might abuse the chair and ask
one of my own.
Was William Cecil the first person to push the sense that Elizabeth was the new Deborah? Or had that been...
Well, it first comes out... Before? It comes out in two places. There were Protestants in London, not in Lancashire, but there were Protestants in London in 1558. And in the Queen's coronation pageants, as she went through the city, there was one particular pageant. There were always pageants on the eve of the coronation. You process through the city of London, and the livery companies put on a show. And one of the shows was basically Deborah sitting on a throne with a palm tree, and essentially a little sort of inscription and actors saying that basically Elizabeth was to be the Deborah, the restorer of Israel, the restorer and judge of Israel, which I think is a quote from the Old Testament. And Elizabeth looked at it and is reported to have scowled, because the last thing that she wanted to be was Deborah. When people called Elizabeth, the Geneva Bible, an edition published after Elizabeth has come to the throne, apostrophizes her as various things. And one of them, of course, is this. And it's not what Elizabeth is, it's what, you know, those of a more radical, you know, quasi-Calvinist disposition want her to be. And one of the huge confusions in about all this is mostly, I have to say, coming from English departments in the United States, is that people are now interested in these pageants and they're working on these pageants. Oh, they're the pageants for Elizabeth's coronation. The Queen must have authorised them. And of course, it's compounded by the fact that there's a piece of evidence that you think you can find, which is that the costumes came from the Queen's wardrobe, which was then at the old Blackfriars Monastery, dissolved monastery. That's where the wardrobe with all the, you know, the spare furniture and, you know, whatever, the furniture store and the sort of costume store for things you weren't using was all down at Blackfriars. Now, the only thing that they didn't know was that the Master of the Revels, who had custody of all this, used to rent them out on the side. He was the Angels of Covent, well, that used to be at Covent Garden, then they've moved out actually near Harrow now. But if you're making a movie, or if you're doing TV, you want the Henry VIII costume or the Elizabeth costume, you go to Angels, and they rent them out. And that's what's happening here. It's got nothing to do with Elizabeth's personal views. But yes, I mean, Deborah's a big thing, because Henry VIII had been Constantine, he'd been Justinian as a sort of, you know, historical template. He'd been Solomon, he'd been King David, he'd been Hezekiah, all of those things. When Edward VI came to the throne, they needed a boy to do the same job, so he was Josiah. And of course, Josiah had godly counselors who'd, you know, helped to govern with him, so that worked really well. So they're looking for something for Elizabeth. So they try Constantine again. They try, you know, Hezekiah. So it doesn't quite work. But Deborah's a good one for them. So that's
Thank
how it is.
Thank you very much. I ought to have said Deborah, of course, one of the Old Testament figures who restores true religion to Israel. That's the point. Any other questions?
Although the film has quite an interesting take on it, knowing what their characteristics were like, had the two actually been able to meet, do you think anything positive would have been achieved?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was involved in this. The question is, if you didn't hear it, is that if they really had met, would it have been like it is in the film where Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie meet? And my answer to that is, if they actually had met, of course they didn't meet, but if they had met, I think it would have been absolutely like that. I saw that right from the beginning. I wouldn't say I vetted, but I advised on 17 different versions of the script before anybody went into rehearsal or production. And I think that's exactly how it would be. And of course, I knew about the document that I showed you then that, you know, Elizabeth was looking for a reconciliation. And, you know, I mean, they might well have met. But if they had met, I think it wouldn't have worked. There was that residual, you know, by then, mutual suspicion and fear. And Mary probably would have lost her temper somewhere along the line. She probably would have just lost her cool that little bit. Just a couple of minutes that are left. Before filming that scene, actually, it was Margot Robbie filmed all her scenes first. And then Saoirse Ronan filmed all her... Because you don't film the script starting with that one scene one. You know, you do it according to the locations. So Margot did all hers first, and then Saoirse came on and did hers, but they overlapped, and they overlapped for the meeting scene. And although they know each other quite well and are good friends, they did not meet, talk about the script or anything to do with the film until they actually met. And they managed to do that meeting scene pretty much in one take. And that is absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. I mean, both those women are absolutely fantastic actors. Absolutely extraordinary.
I think we're going to have to leave it
there.
Yeah,
of course,
John,
yes.
John, on behalf of everybody here in St. Margaret's, I want to say an enormous thank you to you. Not only have you introduced us so much more deeply to these two women, talked about the politics around them, talked about, as I said earlier, the people pulling the strings, but also introduced us to questions of gender and identity and shown us how exciting career as an historian can be because you would also be a detective. Now, if you haven't seen the film, you really must go and see it. You must get it on DVD. In addition to Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie, you will never forget the sight of David Tennant as John Knox. That is a completely extraordinary portrayal. So please go and watch the film. John, we're massively in your debt this afternoon. Thank you so much.